The following program is an abridged audio version of the streaming video talk show, A Wonderful Chaos. The hosts are Andy Chaliff and Bambos Dimitriou. The format is entirely casual, unscripted conversation. If you'd like to watch a live taping or participate with your comments in real time, subscribe to A Wonderful Chaos on YouTube, Facebook, Periscope, or Twitch.
When you know you just have to do something and you do it, no matter how you feel, no matter what the fear is, that's what courage is, right? It's not the lack of fear. It's doing something that you believe is right anyway, despite the fear. But then it all works out. And the beauty is, for anything that I was afraid of, much more beautiful things have happened as a result.
It's a wonderful chaos. Beautifully random, messy and glorious.
Solo or tandem?
We work to find rest and fight to find peace, both head and the heart.
Like a nephew and niece.
What are we doing here?
You mean listening to this show?
Where the more that you learn is the less that you know. Where the wounded are healers
and the atheists pray.
It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way. It's a wonderful chaos and we like it that way.
Good afternoon, Mr. Shaler.
Good afternoon, Bambos Charles Dimitriou. Today we've got
Rachel Roberts.
Rachel. She's not Rachel. She's American.
Rachel.
Rachel Roberts. Rachel Roberts. We have another show, which we have a large following that enjoys these shows, and they are about the religious cult of Christianity. And we've had different varied like flavors of cult-like activities. So we're going to discuss her. And she's got a group of 100 million people that have a movement called the Nun Movement, because not the N-U-N like nun, but the N-O-N-E,
N-O-N.
Because they're non-denominational and they don't have any religion to speak of. So you asked me in the break, you said, Andy, what is this number and what does it mean? So Rachel has basically acting as the voice for 100 million, and I'm assuming these are Americans because that's where she lives, 100 million Americans who, when they say, what is your religion, they have the answer, none. And then you whispered in my ear, does that mean that they're atheist? And I said, I don't think so. That means they don't have a religion. Mm. And of course, we can get into the difference. I've often said, if someone said to me, are you an atheist? I'd say no, because then I have to believe something.
Oh, yeah. like, we've never really discussed it. What's your relationship to Jesus?
I can tell you, as I've mentioned a few times on the show, when the priest was taken out of the school I was in because he was molesting kids and he was never held accountable, I sort of lost all of my faith in religion.
Oh, right? But I'm not talking about the church. I'm talking about the actual spiritual part. If you take...
Oh, I love Jesus. Yeah. Oh, my God. Yeah, yeah. Let's get that clear. Like, I think... If you look at any of these people who were spiritual practitioners in their time,
yeah,
then they had a following, and then people abused their teaching. They manipulated it in ways and contorted it in ways
to control the whole,
to control societies. And so the beauty of their teachings was lost in the translation generation after generation. If that's how I really feel.
Yeah, yeah.
If you really want to understand the beauty of a spiritual awakening, then you could look at Jesus's life and say, wow, what an incredible awakening experience. Like I don't think you need to judge that negatively, and it would be crazy too, but that's not what we're talking about. We're talking about that once we take this one man's individual experience and then we take it and we create laws and regulations and value statements, good and bad,
you go to hell.
Yeah, like Jesus says, like, be forgiving to the prostitute. And now, but the religion says, hey, let's make sure that that one isn't led into the church. You know, like exactly what his scripture says is counter to everything that the behavior is.
Yeah.
And I was fed up with that at a young age.
And you never read him saying good or bad.
Do you not? I don't know.
Well, he's never, at least in the books, he's never been quoted as saying, this is good, this is bad.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, you know more than I do then.
And Bulelang.
From South Africa.
who is an avid part of our show. In the Bible story, I love the character Jesus.
Yes. And my question to Bolalang, how do you feel that Jesus is always portrayed as some white guy when we know he was black? Like, how is that? Like, when are we going to start portraying the characters as they would actually have lived in the time that they were?
So not blue-eyed and blonde.
No, it's we're not Kevin Costner as Jesus. So with that, Rachel's sitting and like, what the hell have I gotten myself into? Keep in mind, she was brought in because somebody else told her she should be here. So, hey, Rachel.
Hi there.
Hello.
Nice to see you.
Howdy from Texas.
Oh, Texas.
Yeah.
I love your Mr. Potato Head.
Oh, you know, I was hoping you would observe him because he is Captain Kirk Potato Head.
That is brilliant.
Unbelievable.
I absolutely love it. So is there anything that we said which you would say want to correct before we begin? Was Jesus a cool cat in your head, misinterpreted in the years, or do you have no affinity for Jesus?
No, the first thing we need to correct is that Kevin Costner is the wrong person to play Jesus. Because Waterworld just ruined it for me.
Yeah, it did.
No, actually, after The Bodyguard, it went all Whitney Houston and him rocked it there.
Yeah, he should have stayed in Field of Dreams. Like, he's the Field of Dreams Kevin Costner was the best, for sure.
Yeah. The wistful look in his eye and so forth.
Yeah.
He tried to do a comeback recently. It's not really working out.
Nah, I didn't know. I haven't seen that. No.
What I like to say is Jesus is my main bitch.
Nice.
So, you know, but I got some on the side. Because I also like Buddha and Lao Tzu, and there are many other, you know, luminaries inspire me. And then that's one of the things that is common about the nuns is that they don't relegate, you know, to trying to discover or unearth truth just from one source.
Yeah, when we say nuns, let's get it clear. It's not N-U-N nun, it's N-O-N-E nuns.
That's right. Just like you described.
Why would you not call these people spiritualists or some word like that? Why call them nuns?
Well, the term itself came into being around 20 years ago from a sociologist who was just trying to figure out how to kind of, I guess, quantify and qualify these people. And then it was the most obvious thing, just staring them in the face, is that they literally select none of the above as their religious affiliation. And then there are many things that that unify this group of people, but then there are also things, you know, that make them different. So most nuns do consider themselves spiritual but not religious, but depending on the research body, they may or may not also include people who are staunchly atheist and or agnostic. And so that the spiritual term is.
What's the biggest fight that you see between nuns?
The biggest fight?
Yeah. What's the biggest argument two nuns would have? What's like the biggest extreme difference between two different nuns?
You know, that's a great question. And I would think the only one, if there really is one, because in my years of researching this demographic, they're pretty laissez-faire when it comes to, you know, live and let live and do your thing. Let me do my thing. But if there was an argument, I would just have to say it probably would be from the very small percentage of people who are the angry atheist.
The angry atheist
who cannot see any merit whatsoever in the role of either religion or spirituality, because most nuns don't have a problem with religion. They just have a problem with the abuse of religion.
Yeah.
And most nuns are totally cool if religion works for other people. It's kind of, I say in my book, it's religion is like a baseball bat. You can use it to hit a home run or you can use it to bludgeon somebody to death. Mm. And so it's really more along the lines of how do you use the tool? So nuns, for the most part, are like, hey, if religion makes you a more kind, loving person, go for it. It just doesn't work for me. You know? Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it's that it's I see the same in any extreme of anything in life is that the group that wants to vilify it will take the most extreme segment of it and then use that as the whole. So meaning that anyone that is like judging nuns would say, hey, this extreme version, which is the belligerent atheist, they make up, you know, the most of that nun, when actually it's probably a small fraction of really people in that group.
Yes, statistically, atheists, well, self-described atheists account for about 6% of the American population. But when people ask me, do I believe in God or am I an atheist? My response is always define God and I'll tell you if I believe it. Because it just depends on how you define what God is. You know, you can use the term, if you're using the term God to refer to ultimate reality, for example, or some kind of ultimate principle, then I could say I believe in God because I believe in the principle of love and what that's truly the life force of what, you know, the best of humanity. And some people. Actually, Christianity says God is love. And I wrote a credo as a nun. It's called A Credo of Nun. It's on my website. And I say love is God. And there's a difference. There's many gods, but only one love. And a silence entered the room.
We go silent when it's more of a meditation, because it's like you gave the, I don't know what the term is, I always forget these words, but it's like one hand clapping. You have to rest your mind to make meaning of what you've just said. So I'm sitting with the rest in my mind. Yeah.
You're saying a lot anyway.
There's a lot going on.
I had to write a lot down.
I can't believe that there's only 6% that are self-described atheists. I mean, I wonder to myself, would there be more people? Because I would be a nun, and I also wouldn't be a self-described atheist. So I would be, and I always laugh, I've said it 100 times, if you ask me if I believe in anything, I'm going to say no. So even when someone starts a sentence, do you believe? I say no. Like, and they say, but you know what I'm saying? Yeah, because the way you're like, I just think the things are as they are. And sometimes I attach meaning to those things.
Yeah.
Right. So in a way, is there a God? I have no damn clue.
If you had to guess.
If I had to guess, I don't know. I mean, you know, there's.
If you had to guess.
If I had to guess, I would say I have no clue.
If you had to guess.
You know what I would do? I would say I have no clue. That would be my guess.
You're like me. I hate true false questions. You know, it's like not all answers are just.
Well, I mean, what's a good question is you phrased it well to begin with. You said, what's the context that you create God in?
Yeah.
Because the same when Bambos asked me the question, I could have gone into so many nuances and said, hey, Bambos, when you say God, what is it that you're referring to? And I could answer the question yes, or I could answer the question no.
Right.
And so I don't know. I don't know what I'm saying yes or no to until we decide the context of the question is
exactly
what you just pointed at.
Yeah. That's right. I've been reading my book aloud on my Instagram page. And I just read the section called God is a Metaphor. And that's exactly what I'm referring to, is that the word God, well, words in and of themselves are metaphors for our lived experiences. Right.
Yeah.
And before our thoughts. And so the word itself is a metaphor. And then you take the idea of God, and the idea of God becomes a metaphor too, usually for what people are trying to find to fulfill something within them.
Yeah.
And so I always have to, I'll never answer that question just simply. If somebody says, do you believe in God? I'm like, well, do you have couple of hours, you picked a fight with the wrong person
it's almost like someone needs to be fully aware as to their source of belief in any given moment.
And sadly, I don't think many people are. Just kind of believe whatever is kind of dumped on them and go through life and then.
Yeah, you said something really beautiful here, because I'm thinking about Afghanistan and what's happening right now there, right? It's like Afghans are born in that part of the world, and now there's consequences, and we're born over here, so we have certain privileges.
That's right.
And the only thing that separates us is, would I call it luck, fate, God's will?
No.
Yeah, but God's will. People will say God's will.
Yes,
they will say God's will in order to create, in fact, some idea that I am special in a way.
That's exactly right. It's all about the ego.
Yeah, it's a big ego thing. Yeah.
So you were born into a Christian cult?
Technically, I wasn't born into it, but my mother joined it when I was about four or five.
Did she join because your parents had separated and she was looking for some community?
Bingo.
Shit.
God damn, you're good.
Ah. Well, I figured at five, why would you join anything at five, right? I mean, it's like that's an arbitrary time. You got to find community and people to support you, all that kind of thing.
And you were drawn into that.
Yes. Yes.
Can you share a little bit some of your first memories in that space?
Sure. Well, the name of the cult was called the Shepherding Movement. And it was birthed from the hippie movement of the late 1960s, where basically a bunch of these young adults at the time in the late 60s were choosing Jesus over LSD. It was kind of like a natural high, so to speak.
Yeah.
And but they were still had this kind of hippie culture. And what happened was this group of five men started observing that all these young people were on fire for Jesus, Jesus freaks, as they were called. But they didn't have any orientation or any structure because they were anti-church. They were rebelling against the established church, which kind of seemed cool in a way. And then these five men observed this trend within Christianity in the late 60s. And they said, you know, we need to put together basically a network of home churches that can reach out to these young people and shepherd them or mentor them into Christianity, but outside of institutional church. And so it started spreading in the southern United States, and it actually had a presence in Ireland, of all places, just due to a relationship there from one of the leaders. And it basically was this network of home churches. And I describe it as the Amway of Christianity. It was a multi-level marketing kind of deal where everybody had a shepherd, just like you would have, you know, in an Amway situation where you have your, I don't know what they're called.
Your rep above you. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And you had to tithe to that person. And then that person tithed a portion of, you know, it was all male shepherds. That person would tithe 10% to the next person until it got to the very, very top. And so the people at the very top were like raking in the most amount of dough because they were getting 10% of everything down below them. But
it's a religion. So how do they make money?
Well, you make money like the pastors. Once you reached a certain level of being a shepherd, you didn't have to work full time because you were receiving tithes from all these people below you.
And the tithes would just be their salaries or what is that? Oh, OK. Yeah. So 10% of what they earn.
Yeah. So like if there was, let's say in a local home church, you had, I don't know, a congregation of 200 people. And you would have they were called cell groups, which is hilarious to me because that sounds very,
very join a cell.
And so you would have cell groups like smaller divisions, and you would have a little local shepherd who had, say, 10 people under him. So he would receive 10% of those 10 people's income, which are usually blue collar working class people. For the most part. And then the tithes would just kind of work itself up.
I got it. This sounds like a great business model. These guys are smart.
Yeah, because the people who were making the money, you know, as you got up the top, you know, all they had to do was sit around and judge people. And it was a cult because not only for the financial model I just described, but very much a misogynistic structure.
Sure.
As a child and as a female, it was a double whammy, you know, in terms of having no dignity as my own independent person. I was taught that I didn't even have direct access to God, that my shepherd, who was my stepfather, had to basically channel God to me. And so, And so I never knew, you know, I'd come home from school one day. Oh, yes.
I have a question.
Yes.
How the hell did they come up with that?
Yeah.
Well, they picked some random Bible verse and extrapolated upon it.
You take the one verse that actually you can screw up the context that serves you, and you just utilize it.
So,
right.
What's blowing my mind, I love how you emphasized in the beginning, five men.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
I really felt that. And then like I'm hearing about the monetary pros, but I'm noticing you're not really talking about the actual practice of being a Christian. So I'm missing that right now.
Yes, because the practice of being a Christian was to submit to the man who's in charge of you.
And by submit, how do we define that?
Do whatever they tell you.
We're not talking sexually. We're talking about serving.
No, it would apply to that as well. It just depends on obviously the system itself was very dysfunctional, needless to say. But then if you enter somebody into that dysfunctional system who also happens to be an abuser.
Yeah.
It's like just 100 times worse. And so that was my situation. You know, my stepfather was very much an abuser, and so he was able to leverage this system to justify his belief, or excuse me, justify his abuse. And when I made the decision to leave home when I was 16, it was my brother and me, because my younger brother, we were his stepkids. When we decided to leave my mother and my stepfather, I really believed with all my heart that I was rebelling against the God of the universe. And we went to go live with my father, who had been kind of absent most of my life, who happened to be an atheist.
Okay. Help me understand abuse, the word abuse, because it's ringing in my brain right now.
Okay.
How do we help me understand what abuse meant?
Okay. Well, it would mean I would come home from school one day, just any random day, and my stepdad would pull me aside, sit me down in a chair, take off his belt and loop it in his hand and start swatting it in his hand like this. And he'd say, God told me that you cheated at school today. And I would sit there and I would have to determine, do I tell him that I didn't cheat and risk that he's going to accuse me of lying? Or do I admit that I cheat, or do I lie and say that I did cheat? And I learned to lie and say and admit to whatever it is he accused me of doing, because if I didn't admit to what he told me that God told him I did, he would beat me for both. He'd beat me for lying, and then he'd beat me for the offense that God illuminated to him that I had done during the day. That's one example.
I notice as you're speaking, and I've noticed it recently, when people are sharing these kind of things, my fingers start fidgeting because it creates so much tension in my body.
Yeah.
I noticed he was cringing, and it reminds me a little bit about his father, as in you both had abusive fathers in a way that you had to kind of sense into the cues and then act accordingly.
Mm-hmm.
Mm.
I'm really sorry you had to go through that.
Like, yeah.
When I wrote my book, it was difficult to write in some ways, but the truth of the matter is that doesn't really have power over me anymore, you know, and it was wrong, of course. But I don't feel a great deal of burden when I talk about it anymore because, firstly, lots of people go through lots of shit. And so it's not like I feel like I have this sad little world's violin, you know, story to tell, the world's smallest violin here. I think what's more important is, in fact, what's more important is that I channel that energy into something positive and constructive. And that's what I'm doing now through the work of American Nun.
How would you say that experience, though? Like, if we just take away the movement that you're in, how did it shape you as a person?
Well, it really fucked me up. I'm assuming we can use that.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Okay. No, I mean, it really did. And frankly, to be honest, and it's still to this day, I still, you know, like the onion in Shrek, you know, you're peeling the onion. And yeah, yeah. So still to this day, I find layers that I have to peel back that I don't even realize are still a part of me.
Yeah.
Until they get challenged. And then I go, oh man, this is an echo of something that, you know, I was taught or experienced growing up.
Yeah.
And, one of the things I did intentionally do, I did a lot of intentional things. I prioritized mental health as a young person. I was in my late teens when I first started seeing a counselor, a therapist. And I have continued throughout my entire adulthood, you know, going to therapy and reading books and learning what healthy thinking is and a healthy sense of self and all that. And that's evolved over the years.
Yeah.
But then I used to, when I first left home to go live with my atheist father, I hated Christianity. I hated Christians. And it took me a while, but when I was in college, for my bachelor's degree, I studied philosophy of religion. And it was there that I discovered that Jesus, like you were saying in the intro, Andy, Jesus is the shiznit. You know, there's like, if a person has a problem with what Jesus taught, then they really don't, they haven't read what he taught, and they don't know much about him. They've just made an assumption, but probably based on the follower, people who call themselves Jesus followers.
Yeah.
And so I finally learned how to tease out separate the abuse that humans can conduct
in the name of Jesus.
Exactly.
Yeah.
From the truth that someone like Jesus or Buddha or whoever else.
Yeah.
Dolly Parton, you know, I mean, you know, there's so many sources of wisdom and inspiration in the world.
Yeah, exactly. Like the if Jesus existed today, I guarantee you he would be so marginalized that all the wealthy people would say, this guy's an idiot. I cannot.
Yeah,
I'm not going to listen to him. Like if there was a second coming and he sort of showed up, everyone would be looking at this guy like, hey.
I don't think he would want to see those crosses anyway.
No.
No. He was,
So
I agree.
How did this experience impact you as a woman and your relationship with the masculine energy?
Oh, man, that is a powerful question. That really is. And it has affected me most of my adulthood because even when I got over what I thought was the effects of the cult.
Yeah.
And even after reading, like in the 90s, I read Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus and, you know, and read, you did all the stuff. I thought that I had things figured out, but I definitely carried forward into, I've been married and divorced twice. And, And I carried into those marriages not having a good, solid sense of self. And that whole thing about submitting to men was something that was literally beaten into me. And so even when I no longer believed that as a principle and no longer believed the Bible stuff that was used to support it, it was like this deep reflex of mine to just kind of go along with whatever and allow a man to basically tell me, you know, what was up and what, you know, tell me what my reality was. And it's embarrassing to say this because I'm not proud of it. And unfortunately, a lot of Christianity glorifies women like that, right? And a lot of society still does. And so I am determined that that will no longer be, I will be single for the rest of my life before I will do that again. I don't want to be single for the rest of my life, but I will because it's destructive.
Yeah. Yeah, it was a good question. I mean, it was a great question because I had it myself. I was phrasing it differently in my head. Like, I was thinking along those lines, like, where would you feel triggered by men? Like, what would be the behavior you'd say, oh, yeah, that's where I see myself reacting to?
The answer to that question today would be different than it was years ago because, like the onion, I've kind of peeled things back to where it's gotten very specific. And so now the answer to that question is I would be triggered if I were to state something like, hey, I like pina coladas in the rain. And the dude says, no, you don't. You don't like rainy days. And then I'd be like, oh, yeah, you're right. I don't.
Oh, shit.
You know what's funny?
That's where I will often get triggered as well.
Pina coladas in the rain?
Not the pina coladas, but the underlying thing you just said.
Yeah.
If I share my experience without judgment towards it, and then a person starts imposing on me their interpretation of events and how I am really feeling, where I see no compassion or any groundedness in there, I'll be like, hold on. No. You don't get to do that. Like,
right.
You don't get to like make assumptions, especially without any questions being asked.
Right.
You know, and I see in a way I didn't think about it till you just said it just now. But I noticed I have a similar, that's one of those areas I'm like, no, I'm not going to play that game, because the only way that it works is if I accept your interpretation and let go of everything I know to be true. So you feel comfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
It's having your own sense of agency.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the irony of things, is when you allow someone else to own their own agency, then ultimately they're free to love the way that you want to be loved. But when you impose yourself on someone else's agency, then it's a death dealer.
Yeah. What would have triggered you before? Because this is what triggers you now, but what would have triggered you before?
Yeah. So what I just said would be something that I hadn't figured out yet. This has been a more recent, like, fine-tune thing. So what would have triggered me before would have been something along the lines of, abuse, like physical abuse. I've never been in a relationship that involved physical abuse, because if that was something I knew that was concrete. Yeah. And I knew that if you even remotely get close to something like that, then you know what I mean?
I know what you mean. Yeah.
But I dealt with verbal abuse in some relationships, and then I've dealt with emotional abuse, which took me a longer time to realize that there is such thing as emotional abuse.
Sure.
And so, you know, I had to,
So, I mean, it kind of must be, there's two journeys, actually, if I hear, is there's the journey, of course, out of religion, and the remnants of that have then been playing themselves out in different ways.
Yes.
And you're just kind of learning how to, like, be in relationship kind of more with yourself, actually. And then, of course, with the other as a consequence.
That's exactly right. And it makes me, that the whole experience has made me so much more compassionate towards other people.
Yeah.
Because we just, you never know what somebody's struggling with.
Yeah.
You know, and you never know what demons, the haunts in their head and the narratives that are playing in the back of their minds.
Yeah. I've written two books and I'm finishing the third one now. And one of the things that happened in the third one is that I put questions at the end of each chapter. And today I made the decision to put the answers I give to those questions at the end of the book as well. So not only are people being asked the questions, but I'm answering them myself. And the questions today were me saying, if I track back my behavior to the belief behind that behavior, what are the questions that lead me back to the belief? So I did that process today. Mm-hmm. And then the belief was that I'm alone and no one understands me. That was the belief that I had. Wow. And then I said, well, how would it be if I changed that belief? And I turned it into, we're all alone. And by seeing everyone's alone, I have compassion. When I look out, and what I noticed is that as soon as it didn't become woe is me and wow, this is an incredible human experience that we all share, the eyes of compassion immediately shifted and seeing everything differently.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
So
that's beautiful.
I was reminded by that as you spoke just now. You said earlier that God is relative. My dad always said to me, I am God.
Can we slow down?
Yeah.
I feel for actually leaving right now. I'm sitting here with you and I'm seeing the little girl in you sitting there and having to deal with that belt.
Mm.
And I'm just really sick in my body right now. And I know you said, oh, it's everyone has abuse, but still I'm feeling that as a visceral experience.
And I had the same.
And I don't want to skip it. Like in my body, it feels like, ah. And the fact that you're even sitting here right now with two men and you said yes to the interview without even knowing what kind of men we are, that touches me even deeper.
Well, thank you for sharing that. I appreciate that. I appreciate that. I appreciate, this is the first time I've been gotten kind of teary on an interview. So thank you. I that's kind of you to say. And, you know, I think that when it comes to this shared energy that you're picking up on right now, the only way I know how to deal with it is to, like I said earlier, convert it into something positive and constructive and life affirming into the world. And so even though I'm just now having the privilege to meet you guys, I appreciate that to know that you two are out there and illuminating stories like this and sharing your care and compassion for people, because you know, we think about the people in Afghanistan, just like you mentioned earlier. You know, I mean, what I experienced growing up was nothing compared to what the girls and women there are experiencing and are doomed to experience with what's happening. And so every little bit of work that we can do to just shift consciousness and the way that humans do things in the world matters. And I appreciate you acknowledging that. Thank you.
No.
You mentioned you wrote a book and all those copies behind you. So
yes.
The decision to write a book means you picked up your phone and you typed like he did, or you took a pen and paper, but you actually made a decision to write a book. And the journey of writing a book, you had, in a way, you had to relive the past. So was that? How was that process for you?
It was harder than I expected it to be. And I have a few other books teed up for me to write next. And I can't wait to actually get to the business of writing them, because I'm not the very first book. Allow me to show you.
Please bring it out.
The very first book is Confessions of an American Nun, and a credo of sorts. Yeah. And it was indeed, it's basically my coming out book. It's my coming out book. And that's why I put myself on the cover like a badass, because partially because I designed the cover myself. So I didn't know what else to put on there.
Yeah.
But also really because I wanted to say, you know what, I'm coming out, deal with it, you know, and it's my journey of leaving organized religion into this new space. And I want other people to feel free to do the same and to come out and own that space. Because at least in the United States, it's still a pretty murky thing, depending on where you live in the United States, too. But to answer your question about what was it like to write it, it was, I felt like, you know how in the movies, if somebody's about to faint, or in the cartoons, like how the field of vision goes narrow, narrow, narrow to like a pinpoint before it blacks out. I kind of felt like I was living in this narrow little tunnel when I was writing at least parts of this book, because I was having to go back and kind of conjure up some stories and stuff that were not really great to feel. Mm. But I told them because I decided I'm not going to protect or defend or obscure abusers anymore.
Yeah.
And I don't use the names, anybody's names in here, but because I'm also not vindictive, but I thought, I think too many humans have lived and died with skeletons buried because they didn't want to cause ruffles or whatever. Yeah. And I decided I would rather, you know, cause some ruffles and deal with that than continue to protect people or institutions that are operating in ways that harm people.
Yeah. Did you get anyone to react to it in the family when they read it?
It depends on which side of the family you're talking about.
I guess your dad's side of the family was probably far more interested in your story.
Yeah, my dad and his side of the family is much cooler with it. But on my mom's side of the family, which, by the way, she ended up divorcing my stepfather a few years after I left home. And then she converted to Catholicism.
It's another version of the same cult. Okay.
but I don't think they've read the book.
No. Okay.
I don't think they've read it. And we kind of have this, you know, Clinton era policy of don't ask, don't tell.
Nice.
You know, about otherwise I probably could not be in relationship with my mother or at least one of my brothers.
Okay. And if you're at like a dinner table, these subjects don't go discussed, I'm presuming.
Yeah, I don't go there. I love them.
Yeah. Yeah. You're not going to win. There's no winning in that discussion. So why even enter it?
Right. Yeah. It's not about winning.
No. two things came up. If something like that happened with me and a parent, and that would be just me doing that, it would be like sharing how it was for me without blaming them and allowing them to meet me there. But and if they would or not, but at least I wouldn't want it to go unspoken.
That's a beautiful way to handle that.
I learned it from him.
but always in the right conditions. I don't enter the bull ring with a red cape on if I see that I'm just going to get chewed up, right? Like I choose my battles well.
When you were writing the book, did you censor or soften any of the events?
Ooh, that's a great question. No, I didn't.
Nice.
I didn't. I tell some pretty self-deprecating stories in there as well. That are kind of, you know, kind of embarrassing. But I was like, you know what? Screw it. It was like what you were saying earlier, Andy. When you realize you were feeling alone, and then you realize, wait, everybody feels alone, and then it levels the playing field.
Yeah.
That's kind of what I decided when I wrote this book was, listen, we've all felt things, done things, been things, you know, et cetera, good, bad, ugly, indifferent, whatever. And if we could all just admit it, then we don't need to pretend anymore. So, I mean, I tell all kinds of stories.
The problem is, and this is the beautiful problem that everyone is going to face in their lives if they really want to live a fulfilling life. At one point, we have to accept that what we want, desire, does not fit into societal norms. So you, Bambos, and myself, we've allowed ourselves to share the things that could be judged most by society. Mm-hmm. And then within that sharing, it's not done to shock per se. Others would think that because they haven't made peace with their own demons. So they have to judge others. And so now when you reach that space, it's hard to explain to somebody who is not that free. Because there'll always be a reason that they can't be that. I can't be that free because my religion or because my parents or because my boyfriend or whatever whatever the excuse or the belief system that stops it. So in some weird way, there's like these levels of freedom that one attains within themselves. And hopefully one of the lower levels, but for some, it's the most extreme level is allowing themselves to be free of social norm.
Yeah.
And that's what I hear with you.
You know, it's funny in this book, I have different themes in each chapter. And one of the chapters, the chapter that because I wrote my book in the form of a credo, which was lovely irony for me since I went to seminary. I got my master's in theology. And let's see, what chapter is it? I should know since I wrote it. So on the chapter in beliefs, and I I use the theme of me. Hold on just one second. You'd think I would know my own.
Your own scripture, please.
My own.
Don't worry about it. Andy doesn't know his.
The book according to Rachel Roberts, verse 1.
Yes, yeah, it is. It's chapter 3 on beliefs. Anyway, I use the theme of how I was a lesbian in college and dated women in college. And this was back in the early 90s. And so this was before it was like as acceptable as it is today. And of course, part of the reason why I went down that path was because I had been so abused by men. But I made a very intellectual decision when I was 19 that I didn't trust a man as far as I could throw him, but I didn't want to be lonely. And so I thought, well, okay, as I put in the book, I'll just, play Hello Kitty for a little while and see how that goes. And so when I wrote this in the book, it was a big deal for me to come out in that way too, because most people who knew me didn't know that about me. And I'm like, I'm a mom with three kids, ages 13 to 20. That was a big deal for me to write this. And then I was a little nervous because my younger kids didn't know about it. And I thought, and then now they have transgender friends. And so they're like, who cares?
Mom just became cool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, who knew? Because back then I was all afraid. I remember going up, through the 90s. And once I had gotten married, I was like, will my kids ever find out? And then look how the world's changed, It's a good thing.
When you were writing the book, did you discover or remember memories which were forgotten or buried? Like, as you're writing, did you have that moment like, oh, fuck, that happened and I completely forgot about that?
I would say some things came back that I hadn't fully forgotten, although my brother sometimes reminds me of things that I didn't remember. Mm. We remind each other.
Yeah.
Because we remember different things. And my brother just told me the other day, he reminded me of this that I had forgotten, where he was like, we were talking about growing up in this wacko world. And he said, I'll never forget when mom was making a big deal about how men shouldn't have long hair. And you were like, but didn't Jesus have long hair?
Actually, curly hair.
But at the time, that's, you know, that was the Jesus we knew, right?
I was going to say, that's the rationale of every kid is look at the obvious. Isn't it obvious?
Yeah. Thank you.
From the mouth of babes.
When you published the book, like when you went out into the world, what happened inside you?
I was kind of a little scared.
Like when you say scared, help me understand. Like if I feel into it, everything that you're saying that you were exposing, I'd have cold sweats. How was it for you?
I did experience quite a bit because I was worried about my family and the family that I love. That was probably my biggest concern. And I was even a little worried about, not that I wanted to protect my stepfather, but I definitely did not want to, I had no interest in there appearing to be any kind of vindictive move because he's gone on to live his life. And from what I hear, he's mellowed quite a bit and whatever, and, you know,
old age.
And so, I was pretty nervous. And I also have had Christian friends. I went to seminary. I have a ton of minister friends. Now, I went to a very progressive liberal seminary here at SMU in Dallas. But still, I was like, there will be some people who aren't going to even read it or really try to seek to understand. And so I was kind of scared. But then it's like when you know you just have to do something and you do it, no matter how you feel, no matter what the fear is, that's what courage is, right? It's not the lack of fear. It's doing something that you believe is right anyway. And despite the fear. But then it all works out. And the beauty is, for anything that I was afraid of, much more beautiful things have happened as a result. So yeah.
I can imagine also relationships got closer, or at least some.
Well, yes. Relationships that I didn't even anticipate. You know, people coming forward and going, oh my gosh, like the Instagram videos that I make, I have found that there are people who are paying attention who don't let you know they're paying attention and watching who don't necessarily comment or whatever, or like it, but they're there and they're watching. And then I'll get like a message from somebody out of the blue, like, I really appreciated what you had to say in that video, blah, 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 you know, whatever. Yeah. And I'm like, okay, that's worth it.
When you wrote the book, before you put it out there, were there people that were close to you that you wanted to tell them what was in the book before it would go out? Or did you just let everyone at the mercy of finding out themselves?
Yes, that's my family. Yeah, mostly my family. I will say that I told a story. One of the stories I tell in the book was of an elder who had sexually abused me when I was little. And then when I came out and told the church elders when I was older, like in my teens, the church covered it up, and, you know, same old story. And unfortunately, the daughter of that man had, via social media, had, you know, realized I wrote a book, and apparently she read it, and she, you know, she realized something about her dad she didn't know, not because I used his name, but because she could piece some things together. And, you know, it was a weird ethical conundrum for me, because I wasn't wanting to hurt her. I wasn't wanting to hurt anyone, but I ultimately determined that if we have to speak.
Yeah.
People, humans, we have to speak up.
And how did you find out about this? Did they reach out to you afterwards, or how did you know
she was actually so upset. She asked somebody else to reach out to me, and then kind of brokered a a conversation. This other person that we both knew from my childhood brokered a communication between the two of us. That's how painful it was for her. And it really hurt me to know that something I did caused her that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, here's how I think. The fact that this individual sexually abused you as a child, and the fact that, I want to use the word, get, he got away with it.
Yeah.
Then after, what comes to me is like, how many more children followed?
Right.
Yeah.
That's totally right. And that's one of the reasons why I didn't have a problem telling the story. But I look back now and just like how sexual orientation has become so much more acceptable, you know, diversity in sexual orientation has become so much more acceptable in society. Same thing with discussing things like sexual abuse and stuff. It's now something that we can actually openly talk about. And back then, when I came forward in the late 80s about it, it just got swept under the rug. And it was just kind of like, nobody talks about this stuff. And I look back and I wish that I would have had the resources that people have today, because I would have known I needed to do more to prevent that from likely happening to other children.
You know what, like kind of frustrates me in life is that, so like there's a perpetrator, and in a way the perpetrator is allowed to get away with it, as Bambo said in his wording earlier, because as a society, we're not allowed to state openly, well, this happened and it was from this individual.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, like, if everyone who was a perpetrator knew that at some point that their name was going to be clearly and they were going to have consequences, even if the person was 40 by the time they felt comfortable enough to talk about it, then how would that change, if at all? Maybe they're not even conscious or aware or caring about that consequence. But it's for me, it's like I want this guy's name ablazon on a street sign. You know what I mean? But not for vindictiveness, but for holding one responsible for their behavior, which is very different. It's as if to say, you know, we don't have to say, oh, we want this person to suffer. It's no, we want them to be held accountable for what they've done. And that's always, it's always aggravated me. You know,
hashtag me too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Everyone's Agnostic is a show which you mentioned you didn't know Cass Midgley, but Cass Midgley had one of the top five spiritual shows on Apple Podcasts for under the spirituality label. And he is basically an atheist on a crusade.
Okay.
So he did, I don't know how many shows. He had me on one of his shows, and he said he was short on people, so he took me on anyways, thinking that I was going to be a shitty guest. And we became dear friends. And his show is incredibly popular. He gave me the stats one day, and it blew my mind. You know, one of his shows is more downloaded than all of our shows together. And we've done 268 of them. Okay. And basically he was really interesting because as I spoke to Cass, he's also the audio engineer. He's also the reason why we're in contact on this show, because he basically connected us to Rachel Roth, who then said, hey, I can't do it. But she said she proposed you to us. I would strongly suggest you at least, checking out Everyone's Agnostic, because although he's not doing the podcast anymore, because he said, Andy, I've done it so many years, I'm against crusading against Christianity or organized religion. He still does this podcast and edits it for us kind of more as a favor than anything else, because he just appreciates what we're doing. We appreciate him. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll definitely have to check it out.
Yeah. And this weekend in Tennessee, he's having a retreat where basically there's 40 people who just loved his show showing up to a house in Tennessee to spend the weekend together. And that's all organized, not because of him organized. It's just his listeners are so galvanized together as a group that every year they come together to just share time, because they've all had traumatic experiences coming out of religion.
Hmm. Yeah, I would definitely like to connect with him. I'll definitely follow up on that, because on the American Nun website, we share stories of people, and I'd love to maybe do a feature on him too.
Yeah, he's a wonderful individual. He was also a, what do we call that, a pastor or a minister? He was also a minister who came out the back end, a different person altogether. So
yeah, yeah.
So thank you for being with us.
Thank you so much for sharing an hour with me. And I want you to know that I feel your compassion and your kindness and your care. And I know that it's not just for me, because anytime a person expresses what you both have expressed with me today, that's just the way you are. So it really makes me feel good over here in Dallas, Texas, that you two are in this world and sharing that loving energy. I love it. Thank you.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful chaos.
We like it that way.